Genesis 18, we've been looking at the fact that Abraham received a couple of visitors, three to be exact. Two of them were angels. One, we believe, is the Lord Himself. As you see, the language of the passage is clear that it is God Himself who is there with Abraham. We believe it is a Christophany. That means an appearance of Jesus before His incarnation. So it is Jesus walking and talking with Abraham and two angels. And we were looking at last week, verses starting at verse 16. I'd like you to look with me at verse 16. Let me read that so we'll kind of catch up to where we're at. When the men got up to leave, they looked down towards Sodom, and Abraham walked along with them to see them on their way. Then the Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Abraham will surely become a great and powerful nation, and all nations on earth will be blessed through him, for I have chosen him so that he will direct his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just, so that the Lord will bring about for Abraham what he has promised him." God decides to take Abraham into his confidence about what is about to happen to Sodom and Gomorrah. And we talked about that last week. We talked about two possible reasons that God decides to take Abraham into his confidence. Abraham, number one, would influence generations yet to come. And he had to understand, and they had to understand, that what happened to Sodom was not just an accident, but rather it was God's divine judgment. All right? The second reason, and that's what we were talking about last week and where we're going to pick it up this morning, the second reason God takes Abraham into his confidence is because Abraham's influence over his own family. After all, verse 19 says, "I have chosen him so that he will direct his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just." Abraham had the important responsibility and the important duty of instructing his household, of instructing his family. And you and I today, as parents, have that same responsibility before God to instruct our children in the way they ought to live, to instruct our children in the way they ought to walk before God. It's an awesome responsibility. It's a solemn responsibility. We began to talk about it last week. We began to look at some things we should do, some things we should teach. We also began to look at some things we should not do. We're going to continue that discussion this morning. Now, let me share with you what one writer has said. Abraham must know what God is about to do, for he will teach his household. If our children be the Lord's, they must be nursed for him. They must be trained up in his work. Abraham made it his care and business to promote practical religion in his family. He did not fill their heads with speculation or doubtful disputation, but he taught them to keep the way of the Lord, to be serious and devout in the worship of God, and to be honest in their dealings with all men. Now, I want to tell you, this is a solemn responsibility for those of us who have children, for both mom and dad, and particularly for dad, I believe. It's a solemn responsibility. That's why it's so important, dads, that we be engaged with our children and we be leading our families in living righteously and in leading justly. And it's even more important with the fact that we live in a society that is deteriorating. And it's just more and more and more we see the foundations of our society crumbling. We need to be sure that we are teaching our children the proper way to live, the proper things to do. Kathy was reading the paper the other day. We were driving somewhere or other, and on a trip recently, and she came across this headline: "Cheating is rampant both in and out of the classroom." And so she began to read to me, and it was from a Dear Abby column. And it was two teachers who were responding to something that Abby had said about the way morals are leaving our society. And this is what they said, and Kathy shared this with me, and I thought, I've got to share this with you, because it's a picture of what's going on. Dear Abby, my husband and I recently retired from teaching at a highly rated, competitive Midwestern public school. Cheating was rampant, from copying homework to text messaging during tests in the classroom. Cheating occurs in the classroom, in sports, in extracurricular activities, and in the hallways, and has become more acceptable among students than ever before. Teachers are practically powerless to control us. Administrators seem to have no idea how to handle it. Parents don't want to get involved for fear of angering their children. My husband and I tried many times to make students understand that what they were doing or thinking was wrong and needed to be corrected, only to be met with an incredulous stare, a sneer perhaps, and then, "Can I go now?" We began asking ourselves that same question and realized last year that we could go now. And we did. More of our time was spent trying to teach moral values and ethics, and less was spent on the required curriculum. You were right when you said people's codes of ethics have taken a nosedive in the last decade. It's rampant in every aspect of life, as you mentioned, but when it's rampant in our schools, it eliminates any chance of fixing it for coming generations. And of course, we know that if it's rampant in our schools, the reason it's rampant in our schools is because it's rampant in our homes. What's winding up in our school is the product of the homes of America. You and I have got to swim against that tide. We've got to do even as Abraham was supposed to do, and that is to correct our children, to direct our children, to help them to live righteous lives, to help them to live just lives, to help them to live and treat other people in a proper manner. And so we're going to talk about that some more this morning. I want to share with you some guidelines from the Compact Guide to the Christian Life. It's that little book that I've mentioned to you many, many times before. I really, really like that little book. The church purchases them by the carload, and I get to give them away. If you never got your copy, see me. I have a few more left, and if not, I'll get some more in. It's a tremendous little book, a great guide to living the Christian life. There's a section on what parents should train their children in. What are the things that you and I as Christian parents, and particularly you and I as Christian fathers, should be teaching our children, training them in? Let me kind of give you the list here. We should be training our children, teaching our children to pray. And by that I mean not that they see a bowed head, because they don't know if we've dozed off or if we're meditating on the latest baseball scores, or, you know, they don't know what we're doing. So unless they hear us, they don't know what prayer is. So we have to train our children to pray. We have to train our children to worship. That's why it's so important to be consistent in going to church. And I know most of you are, and I'm thankful to God for you. We have just an awesome congregation here. I tell you what, I am blown away by you. You are amazing. Absolutely amazing. But we've got to be consistent. We've got to regularly and consistently attend worship so our children learn to worship. We have to train them to read the Bible with understanding and benefit. And that can happen whether they are at the toddler stage or whether they are teenagers. We can, you know, we believe in, we get, what do I want to say here? Okay, what I want to say is this. We have so partaken of the franchising mentality today. You know what? If you have a good hamburger stand, then turn it into a franchise and franchise it all over the world. And we do that in the church. We franchise out to somebody else the teaching of our children from the time they're small until they're older. And we forget it's our responsibility. It's our responsibility. You can't franchise that out. We need to teach our children. We need not just to depend on other people to do that. Not to depend on Awana or the Learning Center or junior and senior high youth. We need to be doing it ourselves. We need to help them to train them to read the Bible, to understand it, to benefit from it. We need to teach them to turn to Jesus when they have a need. We need to teach them to turn to Jesus when they have a need. We need to teach, remember, all this comes from the Compact Guide. I want you to understand it. We need to teach them the central truths of the faith. They ought to understand what salvation is, how we get salvation, how a person's saved. They ought to understand. They ought to understand basic things like we are all sinners. That's what the Scripture teaches. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And they need to know that God has done something about our condition. In that while we were yet sinners, Christ did what? Died for us. And we have to do something about that. We have to put our faith in Him. Transfer our trust to Him. They ought to know the basics. They ought to know the central truths of the faith. And because if we don't teach them... By the way, let me recommend a couple of books. Just popped into my mind a couple of books. Books by Paul Little. Paul Little was killed in an auto accident. You often wonder why God allows some great servants to be taken home early. Paul Little was one of those. Oswald Chambers was another. Taken home at the prime of life. But Paul Little wrote a couple of books. One called How to Give Away Your Faith. Maybe some of you have read that or studied it. How to Give Away Your Faith. He's written books about doctrine. Know what to believe. Know why you believe. If you've never read those, if you've never had your children read those, you must do that. If you have children that are going to college, you have got... We did this with both our boys before they went off, before they left our home. I made them read, know why you believe, and know what you believe. The reason is, I wanted them fortified. I wanted them to understand, especially to know why they believe. Why do we choose to live the way we do? Why do we choose to believe the Bible? Why do we choose to follow God? I wanted them to know there are good, rational reasons for that. Because I knew there was going to be some nutcake professor at the college where they went to who was going to tell them it's all a fiction. I'm sorry, I get a little excited about this. There are a lot of good professors out there. Don't get me wrong, our kids had some fantastic ones. But are your kids prepared for that? We've got to teach them the central truths of the Word. We've got to teach them to love others, to love themselves. There's a proper self-love, by the way. There's a proper self-love. All self-love is not bad. We've got to teach them to obey authority. We've got to teach them to control their impulses, particularly to delay gratification. We have the... If you want to see what a culture is like that doesn't understand delaying gratification, just look at our culture. Do anything you want at any time you want it. If it feels good, do it, and do it often. They've got to be taught to delay their impulses. They've got to be taught to act responsibly, to deal with the moral conflicts of secular life. They will encounter them. They will encounter them. They've got to be taught some very practical things. I love this part. They've got to be taught how to manage the skills of living on earth. Things that we don't think of as spiritual. You know, we divide our lives into little pigeonhole boxes, and this is spiritual. It's Sunday. I must be spiritual today. And we say, balancing my checkbook isn't a spiritual act. You better believe it's a spiritual act. Paying my bills on time is a spiritual act. Learning to live within my means is a spiritual act. See, we've got to teach our kids that. We've got to teach them how to manage the skills of living on earth. Got to teach them to wash clothes. I just to tell the truth. You know, fess up. When you got to college, did you know how to wash your own clothes and take care of your stuff? And if we could just get them to understand, they also have to wash their sheets. You know, sheets and pillowcases, you know. Okay, that's a whole nother story. We need to teach our kids how to cook. How many of you guys know how to cook? Whoa, I'm blown away. How many of you gals know how to cook? No, I just... Okay. All right. I want to share something with you. I came across this the other day. One of the two or three books I'm reading right now, you know what happens to you. You start reading a book, you get a little bored with it halfway through or two-thirds of the way through, and you start another book because it really looks interesting. I can't wait to get into it. And then you get halfway through that, and then you start a third one. And because I am OC till as long as the sun shines, I am an obsessive compulsive person. I've got to finish the book, so I always come back and finish them at some point. Well, one of the two or three books I'm reading right now is a Dave Ramsey book called Financial Peace Revisited. Financial Peace Revisited. I recommend it highly. It's a great thing. I recommend Michael's class to you, and I also recommend these Financial Peace Revisited. Another great book by him is Total Money Makeover. It's a great book. I want to share, I was reading in this the other day, and I came across this and I thought, wow, this kind of makes the point I've been trying to make. And so I want to share from a chapter of Financial Peace Revisited. It's about teaching our children about the practical issues of life. And he shares a story about a guy named Jack. I don't know if Jack is real or a composite, because he never really says in here if Jack was somebody. And when you hear the story, you'll probably understand why he doesn't say if he's a real person. Jack was 12. I'm quoting here. Jack was all boy, full of energy, and as he approached his teenage years, he checked the fences, his boundaries. One day, Jack marched into the room while several other parents watched in disbelief and, like a mighty general, demanded money from his father. With the tilt of his arrogant little head, he announced to his dad that he was going to the movies, out for pizza, then to the mall. When his passive dad whipped out a $20 bill, young Jack curled up his spiteful lip and scoffed that it wasn't enough to even get across the street. As this little jerk strutted from the room, I'm just reading, okay? I am reading. Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth? I am reading the words on this page, okay? As this little jerk strutted from the room, I just had to say that again, I like that, strutted from the room with another of his compliant father's $20, now $40 total, his dad shrugged, looked defeated, and sighed, saying, "Teenagers these days, what are you going to do?" Jack is now 24. He graduated from college with a business degree 2 years ago, but works 10 hours a week waiting tables. "There are no good jobs out there," he explains. He sleeps until 10 a.m. most mornings, goes out clubbing most nights, still using dad's money. Mom still cleans his room and his clothes and fixes his meals. She cleans the kitchen by herself after the meal. Jack is still a jerk, only now he's a large, lazy jerk. His parents are at their wits' ends and can't believe the choices they are faced with. Do we move him out? Won't he starve? He won't pay his car payment that we co-signed for. Come to think of it, he isn't paying for it now. We are. He won't take responsibility, and we know this is wrong, but you just can't throw your kids out in the street, can you? Well, Ramsey goes on to say, Jack is disabled. He isn't disabled in the classic sense. He just has no character. We all know Jack. Jack's parents caused his disability by allowing him to do nothing and be nothing, and by giving him no instruction on how life works. Children who reach the age of 18 with their entire skill set composed of Nintendo and eating Doritos have been abused. I'm not speaking of child abuse in the sense of sexual or physical abuse, but neglect. The parents neglected the child by not giving him the character traits needed to live successfully. By giving in to every whim and attaching no consequences to actions, the parents had given the child a false sense of reality. We have got to train our children, not just in the spiritual things. You see, if you're a believer in Jesus Christ, all your life is spiritual. Every part of your life is spiritual. Every day of your life is spiritual. Every hour of your life is spiritual. Every place you find yourself in your life is spiritual for you and for me. All right, how can we train our children? Let me share some more from the Compact Guide. How can we do this? What do we do? Well, let me share some really quick things here. Okay, How do we train our children meet biblical goals in their lives and our lives? First and foremost, okay, here's where we start. Give lots of affection. Give lots of affection to your children. That's the well out of which everything else comes. We have got to fill up that well of love, that well of unconditional love, that well of affection in their lives. We've got to fill up that well up so they can draw upon it when they come into difficulties in their lives. I look at it like our children are wells and we're loading them up with love and affection so they can draw upon it. The writer says this, children need lots of holding, hugging, playing, laughing, and talking with their parents. This is especially important for fathers who are less likely to have daily contact with each child. Many counselors believe that children gain security in their identities as men or women Many counselors believe that children gain security in their identities as men and women from clean affection from fathers. Now, you know what? As I read that, I thought that's so true, and a father's role is so important. And then I thought about how sad that he had to add the word clean to affection. That's the kind of culture we live in today, that you have to let people know there are some things that are out of bounds and you ought not to do to your child or any other child. But it's so important. Well, how do we do that? Well, children need, the writer mentions, children need eye contact. They need eye contact. They need attentive listening from us. They need our time. I've shared this with you before when our Andy, who is now, you know, now I look up to him. When he was just a little toddler, he had the cutest way to let us know that we had better be listening to him. He would take those little chubby, well, he was never chubby. He would take those little hands of his and he would slap them on either of your cheeks and put your face right to his. He was absolutely not going to let you give attention to anything else or anyone else but him when he wanted to tell you something. See, that's how much they need that contact. That's how much they need that eye contact, that one-on-one. The writer of this chapter says that also if you have several children, that we ought to do our best to spend some time alone with each of them so that they can get that eye-to-eye. It's so important. So we need to give lots of affection. I like what the writer said. Without lots of affection, without letting your children know that they're secure, that they're loved and they're valued, your discipline will seem cruel and your teaching will bounce off a wounded, calloused heart. We give lots of affection. Number two, we are an example. We are an example. If we want our children to say please and thank you, guess what we're going to have to do? Say please and thank you. Don't you just hate that? Don't do what I do, do what I say. Because I'm a man. Well, that's not a man. That's not a man. A man doesn't act like that. A man does what he says. That's a real man. We want our kids to pray, then they need to see us pray and hear us pray. They need to know that we think prayer is important. We need to be an example to them in reading and discussing the Bible. They need to know that we don't just send them off to Bible studies. We study the Bible ourselves. And we find profit in it. We need to talk to our spouses considerately. If we expect them to treat other people with consideration, we have to do that with the people in our lives as well, particularly our spouse. We need to set an example by not griping about coworkers. We need to set an example of handling family crises with grace and trust in God. We need to set an example to them as we rejoice in our Christian life, even in its hardships. I love this story. One of my profs in college was a speaker, and he'd go around the country and he'd speak at various groups, and he went and spoke, he and his wife and his two little girls went and spoke somewhere in the Midwest during and to a winter retreat. And his topic for the week was James 1, count it all joy. You know, count it all joy when you fall into various temptation and you fall into various trials. Count it all joy. The conference was, and the little girls are hearing this all week long. Count it all joy, count it all joy, count it all joy. Come to the end of the week, it's time to go home. He loads up his car, his wife, his little girls in the back seat of the family station wagon, and he's driving back home through Ohio in a blinding snowstorm. And as he's driving along, he loses control of the car. It skids, does some of this, you know, stuff, turns and into the side, along the into the side, smashes into the side, the snow on the side of the road, and they come to a crashing halt. And there's total silence in the car as they're all stunned at what just happened. And from the back seat comes this little voice, count it all joy. Need to teach our children that they can rejoice in their Christian life, even in its hardships. We need to teach our children by our example that it is right to work for a living. They need to see us go off to work every day, providing for our families. The writer says this, your children want to be just like you, and in many ways they will be. Give lots of affection. Be an example. Number three, use verbal teaching. We've talked about that several times already. I just want to say a few more things about it. We need to be ready to verbally teach our children, both in a planned way as well as in teachable moments. As the writer said, teaching should go on throughout life's daily events. Encourage your children to ask why and to tell you how they feel about what happens to them. Be available to talk. Set aside the time at the dinner table to discuss attitudes and values about an issue. I tell you what, the dinner table is so underrated. They've done studies that have shown that families that at least have dinner together have less problems with the issues of our society than families who don't. Dinner is such an important time. A time to find out what's going on in your life. And by the way, if you have teenagers, you're never going to find out by saying, how was today? Okay. What happened today? Nothing. Parenting's hard work. You've got to be creative in your questions. What happened to you today that made you feel like a million bucks? That can't be answered with yes or no. What happened today that scared you? What happened today that challenged you? What happened today that made you sad? That's the kind of questions we have to ask, and ask them at the dinner table, ask them at other times. And then we have an opportunity to teach them. Take advantage of teachable moments. Those teachers, you know what we mean by that? It's educators talk about those times when you're just going about the business of living and suddenly an opportunity presents itself. I've shared before that one day when Kathy and I and Tim and Andy were living in Arkansas, back before we were in Del Rio, and they used to have the craziest storms. We do that here too, but they had a really wild and crazy storm, and we, after the storm, we had gone to Walmart, which is a practice we've continued through all these years. We're going in to the Walmart store. We're leaving our car in the parking lot, going toward the entrance to the store, and all of a sudden before us in the sky was the most glorious, complete, bright rainbow you have ever seen. And of course the boys noticed it, and we said, you know what, this is a teachable moment. So we knelt down on the parking lot of Walmart to explain about Noah and the flood and God's covenant and promise that he'd never again flood the entire earth, and had a chance to share them with them about God's judgment and his mercy in front of Walmart. Another time, I think this was before Andy was born, or Andy was just a toddler probably at the time, we were vacationing. And we were vacationing in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. Anybody ever been to Eureka Springs, Arkansas? Oh, a few of you have. A lot in the first service have been there. It's a gorgeous place. It's the Fredericksburg of Arkansas. Okay, all these little shops, and the difference is, instead of just a flat street that goes forever, they have all these hills, and you walk up and you walk down and you walk up and you walk down. And we had walked that poor little guy through all these stores. You know how he loved that. And we had promised we'd go swimming the next day. We had a swimming pool at the motel. We get up the next day, and it is what? Pouring down, raining. Yikes. So let's pray about this. One of these moments, right? Lord, please make the rain stop so we can go swimming. It didn't stop. And it didn't stop. And then as a father, I'm faced with one of those dilemmas. Now what do I say to him? We told him prayer is effective. Prayer works. We should pray. Didn't stop raining. So he sat down. He said, look, Tim, I'm sorry it didn't stop raining. I know how important it is. You want to go swimming. But you know what? God has a lot of people to take care of. And I don't know, but there may be some farmers in this area who have really needed rain, and this is their opportunity, and their livelihood depends upon it. And maybe that's why God isn't answering our request in the way we like. God always answers, by the way. Sometimes it's yes, sometimes it's no, sometimes it's wait. And that satisfied him for a little bit. And it did stop raining. And we did get to go swimming. And the next day we were leaving for Branson, Missouri. How many people been to Branson? If you've never been to Branson in Silver Dollar City, make plans this afternoon. You got to go. Silver Dollar City is one of the greatest theme parks anywhere. And so we got in the car, packed up the car, got on our way on the trip. And as we're nearing Branson, guess what it started to do again? Rain! And we had a limited amount of time, and we had to go to Silver Dollar City that day. You know, those places charge you an arm and a leg to get in. So you don't want to go for 2 hours. You can't afford to go for 2 hours. So you want to get as much of the day in as possible. So Kathy and I are in the car, and we're talking about that. I wonder if the rain's going to stop, and I wonder if we're going to be able to go to Silver Dollar City. And I wonder this. And suddenly, from the back seat, we hear this voice saying, some farmer must be praying again. teachable moments. How do we train our children? Give them lots of affection. Be an example. Use verbal teaching, both planned and unplanned teachable moments. Use consistent discipline. The writer said this, punishment teaches a child the consequences of disobedience. Children need to feel something unpleasant after a wrong action to really grasp that it is wrong. Reason alone does not work, because like adults, children are naturally rebellious, self-centered sinners. I have to laugh when people, children can't be sinners, or the tabula rasa idea, you know, you're born as a blank slate and we do all these things that mess us up. We're born sinners. That's what the Scripture teaches. We're born with a sin nature. That little infant, when it's got its face all scrunched up and it's really red and it's crying for everything and it's those little clenched fists, where's that come from? From this little blank slate. that's pure and innocent. And then they become toddlers and they want their own way. Where'd that come from, this poor little innocent child? They're sinners. We're sinners. Reason alone, as the writer says, does not work. The writer also says, sparing a child the pain of discipline dooms him or her to a life of conflict, confusion, and misery. Your child won't hate you or be permanently harmed if you discipline them following these guidelines. Let me quickly give you the guidelines for disciplining. Number one, we've already talked a little about this. Show them lots of affection when you're not disciplining them. Remember I said, make that well of love and affection deep. Number two, second guideline, deal with your angers and frustrations so that you aren't tempted to take them out on a disobedient child. You know, so many times you've had a bad day at work, everybody's been after you, and you've just had enough. It's been a long day, and if you're a man, you've spent your 10 to 20,000 words already. That's another thing I was reading somewhere, said that men have about 10 to 20,000 words a day and usually use them up before the end of work. And so they get home and their wives say, "You never talk to me." "Well, I've already used my words." Don't you understand? Women have something like the studies. This is a truth. This is a real study. And I don't remember the figure exactly, but something at least twice or three times that, 20, 30, 40,000 words a day. They've got a lot left over by the time you come home. They want to use them up. But we get home and we're angry and we're frustrated, and then the first thing that happens, we take it out on our child. Third guideline for discipline, be consistent. Proverbs says, consistency, that art a jewel. Thou art a jewel. That's one of the greatest proverbs in the book. Consistency is so difficult. Number four, make the rules clear. Number five, punish quickly after the crime is discovered. See, none of this, you wait till dad gets home. That doesn't work. By the time dad gets home, they've gone on to 20 other things. What am I being disciplined for? I don't understand this. Punish quickly. Next guideline, punish in private. Even a child's dignity is fragile, the author says. And the last guideline, never humiliate your child with names, ridicule, or use a punishment that they clearly find demeaning. And then the writer goes on to say this, consistency means the same punishment follows the same crime always. Your mood doesn't make you more harsh or more lenient. Now listen to this, because this is gold right here, okay? This is gold. Inconsistency teaches children not to avoid wrong behavior, but to avoid you when you're in a bad mood. See, they have learned nothing about discipline. They just learn that when you're in a bad mood, stay out of your way. All right, those are some guidelines. We got to move on, okay? How do we teach our children? Give lots of affection. Be an example. Use verbal teaching. Plan teachable moments. Use consistent discipline. Next is parental unity. If you are not unified in your discipline of your children, they will divide and conquer. They're made that way. They understand how to get their way. And I don't care whether they're the smallest toddler are the biggest teenager, they know how to divide and conquer. If they don't get what they want from you, they'll go to your spouse. And if you think you have a problem with discipline, wait till one of you is disciplining your children and the other one steps in and stops you. Now, by the way, there's a time to step in and stop. Verbal, physical abuse, very good time to step in and stop. Okay? But I'm talking about normal, regular discipline that you just happen to disagree with your spouse about. If you break in, if you stop that discipline, what you're going to do is teach your child that they can divide and conquer. So if you have a problem with the way your spouse is disciplining them, again, assuming no abuse of any sort, If you have a problem with the way your spouse is disciplining them, then what you need to do is get with them privately and talk about it and come to an agreement. But if you're not in agreement, I tell you, you don't have a hope. You don't have a prayer if you, as husband and wife, are not in agreement about your discipline. You're in for a long time of a lot of pain. All right? Parental unity. Parents need, I'll just quote here, parents need to agree on what they want to teach. They need to set consistent examples and agree on the discipline that will go with each infraction. The father must stand behind the mother's decision and action and vice versa. Children learn to play one parent against the other when there is disunity. Next, how do I train my children? Support. Accept support from other Christians. Seek emotional and prayer support from other Christians. Why do we always think we have to go it alone? Why do we always buy into the independent spirit of our culture? If you're having trouble, get help. Go to another believer. Ask them what they've done in a similar situation. Last but not least, take the long view. You know, along the way, your children are going to rebel. Along the way, they're going to get away from the Lord, perhaps. Maybe they won't, and I praise God for those who never do. But for those who do, trust that if you've done what we've talked about here, that what you've taught them will bring, they'll come back. They'll come back to it. And I tell you, there's nothing as great as parenting, and it changes over the years. It changes from when they're toddlers to when they're teenagers, and it drives me crazy when I hear people say, oh no, the teenagers are coming, I know it's going to be awful. It is not going to be awful unless you think it's going to be awful. It is not. If you've been consistently giving them affection, if you've been consistently doing the things that we're talking about, when they reach the teenage years, it's not going to be the issue that you think. And I got to tell you, I loved reaching that stage. I loved when we had become more peers with our sons than teacher and taught. And you know what? We've reversed positions now. Now that they're older and away, they're often the teacher and we're often the students. And I love that. I love that. That's a great, great place to get to in your life. Well, why did God bring Abraham into his confidence? Because Abraham would have to know that he had to exercise teaching his children how to live righteously, how to live justly, how to live in this world. That's our job also.